This is Terms of Reference. I'm your host, Stephen Laddick. After 15 years in traditional commerce and revenue-driven fields in the tech industry, Everett Bopp is now focused on making humanitarian processes efficient and self-sustainable. A self-confessed Wi-Fi junkie, he created Disaster Tech Lab after seeing a gap in current response activities related to communication. Over the past 4 years, he's grown DTL from a temporary humanitarian endeavor to a globally operating nonprofit, reconnecting disaster hit communities across the globe by providing rapid response communication services. He uses technology to do good. I spoke with Everett in Ireland. Everett, thank you so much for being on Terms of Reference today with me.
You're welcome. Great to be on and looking forward to it.
Everett, tell me, what is it that you do at Disaster Tech Labs?
What we do, it's basically we're a nonprofit and we provide quite an essential but a very basic service. We make sure that after a certain area is hit by disaster, that the local communities as well as the responding organizations have internet access, and through internet access that they have means of communications with the outside world. That's really, in a nutshell, really simply what we do.
So give me a little bit more detail that. So you help make sure that those disaster areas have internet access. Are you setting up your own ISP? Are you bringing in huge machinery? How do you ensure that that internet access happens for people?
Well, a combination. Let's give you an example, actually. At the moment, just in the middle of a deployment in the town of Bilger, Nebraska. Now, it's only a small town, but it was hit by a double tornado last Monday, which destroyed about 75% of the buildings, but also knocked out all the communications infrastructure in the area. So you go from a town which has such things as landlines, cellular service, internet access to cable, fiber, 4G, whatever, to an area that not only have the local residents without any means of communication, but also all the responding rescue organizations and the relief agencies and the whole influx of aid into that area have no means to communicate with the outside world, with the people in the area, with each other. So we go in, we bring in a combination of equipment. Our local service is we use Wi-Fi equipment for that, because for the simple reason, when I started the organization, I looked at how do emergency response and disaster response agencies and humanitarian agencies, how do they communicate, or what tools do they have already? And what I found out is that a lot of them use their own proprietary radio systems. But that meant that they all had to bring in their own equipment, they had to distribute the equipment, they had to train people on the use of the equipment. So we looked at what do people already have. And, you know, I mean, 4 years ago, there was already a lot of people carry devices that have Wi-Fi connectivity, and that number has only increased now to the point where most people have one, two, or more devices that they carry day-to-day, which can connect to a Wi-Fi network. So that's why we use Wi-Fi technology locally. And then to connect our Wi-Fi network to the internet, the actual physical internet, to call it that, we, in 9 out of 10 cases, we use broadband satellite connectivity, which means we bring in a variety of satellite dishes, ranging from small dishes that are about 3 feet across to dishes that are like 9 to 10 feet across. And then we build out a kind of a Wi-Fi mesh infrastructure from there, connecting different areas Then additionally, once the network is installed, we can offer different services like voice over IP. We can offer Skype calls, anything that people use for day-to-day internet accesses that we can then provide those.
And so you, just to recap, you bring in the satellites, you're connected to a satellite, and then you set up a local area network over Wi-Fi
that
people can connect into.
Exactly. We do also do point-to-point links if there's longer distances that need to be covered.
I've noticed the Disaster Tech Lab. Can I call it DTL? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's what most people do.
Okay, so I know DTL's only been around for a couple of years. What was the genesis for this? And I'm going to assume that you, and I know your history, I know a little bit about you.
Yeah.
How did you go from IT commercial, sort of, your cut and dry commercial world to providing humanitarian services? And what was the origin? What did you wake up and say, DTL needs to happen, I'm going to start this?
Well, there's two things. The actual seed for all what I'm doing now, it goes back to 2004 when we had the big earthquake in Southeast Asia, and followed by the huge tsunami that killed about, 300,000 people all over the Southeast Asia and, made millions of more homeless. I was actually, at the time that was happening, it was Christmas time, and I was driving across Europe on my way to Hungary with my family, and the news was coming in on the radio, and there was news updates, etc. And I was just, as you do, trying to stay awake on the long drive. I was talking to my wife, and I kind of, because I worked with a lot of Wi-Fi technology already at that point, I kind of said, you know what? There's all these organizations are coming in there, and there's a huge influx of different organizations about an aid. But there seems to be a chaos caused by a lack of communication between the organizations, and not so much an unwillingness to communicate, but a lack of means to communicate. So that's kind of where the idea started at that time. And, you know, and it's an idea, a little seed that kind of slowly sprouted throughout the years. And I did some sketches and I worked out some solutions. But, you know, as an entrepreneur running your own business and running a young family, I never actually did anything with the idea until the earthquake in Haiti in early 2010.
Mm.
Which was, you know, a sizable impact, similar to what the earthquake in 2004.
Let me ask you. So, was the same technology available during the tsunami time as in, you know, for Haiti as it is for right now, as you said, in Nebraska, or were you?
No. It was less available. I mean, like I said, we chose Wi-Fi, and I mean that decision was kind of made in 2010 when I actually started the organization. But I mean the use of that technology, it was available. While it was available in 2004, it was less common. I mean, if you roll forward to 2010, you know, Wi-Fi was fairly ubiquitous. The people in general were also much more connected. Connectivity had become more commonplace. So the actual dependency on communications following disaster response was even greater at that point.
And so you woke up, what was the genesis in 2010 to make the leap and do DTL full-time as your sole gig?
It was a really simple thing. I was watching the reports coming in again, and my wife was still there and sitting beside me on the sofa one evening. I said, you know what, I need, you know, this idea that I've been working on I've been kind of talking about for the last 6 years. I think I really need to get my act together and do something with this, because I looked at this need 6 years ago. We're on all this time and there's a disaster and this need is still there. So I took a very simple action. I blog a lot. I blogged more then than I do now because I have a lot of other stuff going on. But I put a blog post up, basically in, you know, a few hundred words outlining the idea I wanted, what I wanted to do and why I think it was needed. And just calling on people to kind of, you know, step forward and say, can we help? And that took off. That got a huge amount of hits on the blog. And I got a whole bunch of volunteers within the next 5 or 6 days from all over the globe, people who actually said, yeah, this is a really valid idea and I'm willing to help with that. And it kind of rolled forward from there.
What kind of volunteers did you get? Are they do they have lots of different eclectic skills and personalities, or is it mostly high tech people, mostly people who've done mapping before, those kinds of things? Or
you get a mix. I mean, you know, especially in the early days, we get fairly eclectic. Most of them would have some kind of telecoms or IT background, but we also got people kind of, you know, general adventurers or people who said, I want to chip in. I don't have exactly the technical background that needed, but I think that what you're setting out to do is a valid thing, and I want to help in some kind of way. So, you know, at that point, I had a commercial IT background. I had no experience whatsoever in humanitarian work. So, you know, I was kind of trying to get that whole thing off the ground. So you do something that basically, as far as I've learned, almost everybody does when they set out, getting an organization like this off the ground. In your enthusiasm, you take on a lot of people, and you might not vet as strongly and as securely as you should do. Mm-hmm. And you take on certain people that you think might help, but in the end, you know, while they're full of good intentions, they're not the right people to bring to a disaster area. And, you know, that's part of the whole learning process that you go through.
That's a really interesting aspect. I'd like to try to dive in there further. So you've set DTL up as a charity, and you depend upon volunteers. Are you the only administrator, or do you have a team of people you're working with at this stage?
No, we have. I mean, you know, here in Ireland, it's myself and my wife who run the organization. We incorporated as a non-profit in the U.S. At the end of last year, and we have a board of four people who are set up there. So it's kind of six people that form the nucleus of the organization at the moment. And then we have a whole team of a whole pool of volunteers kind of spread around the globe at the moment that we work with.
Other than the eclectic skill set and, you know, the the nature of working with volunteers. What are some of the either pros? Why don't you give me some of the pros of working with a volunteer network and some of the cons that you've found have been most detrimental to actually delivering services using volunteers?
Well, there's several things. I mean, because it's a volunteer nation, because as a charitable organization, as a charity, we're not in a position to, and we don't really want to pay our staff. You know, I mean, I've been doing this unpaid so far, but it's just, you can make less stringent demands on what people do. You know, you have to walk a very fine line between making demands and not only in commitment but also in performance of your volunteers, and considering that at the same time that these people give up their time, their money, and well, not so much the money, but their time and their expertise on a purely pro bono basis. So compared in the commercial world, if you hire somebody for a certain task and you pay them a salary for that, if they don't perform, you are in a position eventually just you can make stronger demands and eventually say, okay, you're out. When you're running a charity, yes, of course, the end result, delivering the aid to the people who need it, is the ultimate goal. But you have to walk a line to saying, okay, if somebody goes out there and, you know, to spend, for instance, like we had a deployment in the Philippines at the end of last year, and somebody goes out to the Philippines for 3 weeks and does work there, you are in a slightly less stronger position, and I'm putting this carefully, but you're in a slightly less stronger position to make demands on these people exactly how to do everything all the time when you're paying them.
Sure. What has been your best, or up to this point, how have you found it best to navigate that so that you're getting the highest quality work that you can, but then respecting that sort of volunteer relationship?
It becomes a combination. I mean, first of all, it's a constant learning process. I mean, I've been doing this 4.5 years, and I'm still learning how to handle volunteers best. And one of the things I've learned is that I can't expect the same level of commitment from my volunteers that I give myself, for the simple reason, you know, I run the organization. I'm a lot more invested in it emotionally, physically, and whatever way you want to look at it. Somebody is like a volunteer commits, you know, anything from one day to 1 month to this, and then has their own other obligations, be it work, family, etc. So you know, they're less committed to that, and that there's nothing wrong with that. I've also learned I have to become a lot more selective, that just because somebody wants to volunteer and I'm in need for volunteers doesn't mean I should take them on as a volunteer. I have to really look at them and not only look at their skill set and see if that matches what we need, but I need to also have a long talk with them. Quite often it's a question of using your gut feeling too. What impression does this person give you? Do they come across as stable? Do they come across as somebody who's committed, etc.? And what you need to consider is also, like, because our work is technical, or most of it that we do is technical, but that doesn't mean that a technical genius is suitable to work in a disaster environment. Mm. Because it's a very complicated environment, it's very fluid, things change, you might come across things that are not that pleasant to see or to experience. You experience generally a lot of stress, so you have to deal with that too. So those kind of issues all, you know, roll into the same scenario. So you have to consider all those things, and you have to occasionally say no to a volunteer because you just, on the simple reason, you don't think that while they might have the right skill, that they won't be the right person to on the spot, and that that won't be reliable enough.
Do you have a story of a, what I would call like a rock star volunteer, maybe a go-to person that you always count on for a particular task or need that just always delivers? Or, you know, is there a story where you could tell us?
There's a couple of them.
give me a story about somebody who just delivers fantastic and, you know,
to give an example, I won't name names, but if this person hears it, he knows who I'm talking about. So, but going back, for instance, to our response to Oklahoma last year, when the town of Moore was hit by a tornado, we decided to respond to that. I reached out, as we do quite often, I reached out to my network, not directly of already existing volunteers, but also people that, you know, I'm a heavy social media user. One of the things that we do if we go to an area where we have an existing volunteer pool, I reach out to people that I just know generally through my social media network, like Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever, that live in the area, with twofold purposes. One, to see if they can help us out and actually as a volunteer, but also to get some local data, some local intel, to use a term, just kind of get some feedback. Somebody that I was put in touch with was somebody who lived in Oklahoma City, a gentleman that I never heard of, who actually saw one of our blog posts, I think on Twitter or something, one of that sort of social media, contacted me and says, you know, I'm a very well-skilled network administrator. I want to help you guys out. I had a look at his, I asked him to send me his resume. The resume looked good. I followed up with a couple of calls, came across quite well. So I was going out there myself at the time, and I met up with him, and we went out. And the guy was just an absolute rock star in every way possible. Not only was he technically good, he could get the job done. I could throw a piece of hardware at him that wasn't working and say, okay, can you fix this? Mm. He really good interpersonal skills. He could work. We work with a variety of people, like I said, we don't just work with the auto relief organization. We also work with the community. And a great example was in Oklahoma. We ended up setting up services in a Baptist church, in a synagogue, and in a displaced person tent camp run by a motorbike gang. So, you know, you can't get more different kind of people. And this guy just...
quite a few different personalities there.
Exactly, you know, and this guy just clicked with all of them. He was very, you know, he wasn't bragging, he wasn't a big man. He was a quiet kind of guy, but unassuming, but that his interpersonal skills were good. His logistics skills were second to none. He was handling my inventory like a wet dream. Because, I mean, you can imagine with equipment being shipped all over the place and installed in different locations, keeping track of where everything goes and how it's being handled is a nightmare. Now, this guy was doing this in his sleep. So he's fantastic. And then afterwards, he even said, okay, in downtimes between deployments, he offered to do work on the website, on the back end. So he's been an absolute dream. He's been a nice guy to know. He's been very efficient in his work. He's gone out of his way to help us. And he's never, ever, ever made any demands on us.
Wow, so, that sounds like you found somebody that's a rock. Would that be somebody who might be interested in coming on and helping you to build the organization further? Or is he satisfied being a volunteer?
This is one of those guys that I said, if I had the financial means available, I would hire you on the spot. And that offer is still open, and we're actually working on expanding to get a bit more financial leeway in the organization where we can take on a core of people that actually will do this as a full-time job and manage to be the middle management of the organization. And this guy is one that would be at the absolute top of the list if I was hiring anybody.
Let's jump around for a second and talk about funding, right? You're a volunteer organization. You're a charity. You're donation-driven. I see on your website right now, I'm looking at it while we're talking, you have a GoFundMe campaign for the Pillager, Nebraska tornado relief. Is that your only source of funding? Have you looked at contracts through, you know, organizations? Have you done any outreach to corporations to see if you can get donations? How does funding work for you?
Funding is kind of a twofold approach. Like, I mean, one, what we do for every deployment, we do what you just mentioned. We stick up a GoFundMe page, which is specifically, you know, private donations from people who want to chip in a few bucks towards the thing we're doing right at that time. We also have a pool of past donors that we can we always reach back to, and we have a number of corporate sponsors, to call it like that, and that varies. I mean, you know, there's the financial means that obviously the cost picture that has to be met every time. There's also the equipment, because most of our equipment, 90% that we use, is donated, and we work with a few companies that are there. And Aruba Networks out in California has been our main sponsor since we started, since we went to Haiti in 2010. So they've donated a lot of equipment. We have some contacts with some good other organizations who basically, when we need equipment, we'll just validate what we need it for, and they'll send it out. Flights, for instance, we work with an NGO called Airlink. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
Airlink, okay.
Yeah, Airlink, what they do, Airlink works with a whole, is kind of a mediator between a whole bunch of humanitarian humanitarian aid organizations and the major airlines. And they basically negotiate either donated or discounted flights for humanitarian work. And they work with the UN. They work with all kinds of aid organizations, like from the top of the chain down to relatively small organizations like us. So they help us. And then, of course, we have the financial picture, the financial donations. We have, like I said, some corporate donations, some private donations. We're actually working on getting a bit more structure into that, because continuity is the most important thing in our work, and to provide that, we need to have a more stable funding mechanism, and we're actually working on that, building out some existing relationships into a bit more long-term relationships where we have a bit more financial leeway. So it's kind of a combination of all things. And you know, there's always the challenge. People go, well, why don't you go provide your services on a fee basis? And, you know, while that will be, from one angle, that will be a very logical step, because, you know, you charge for it and then it's easy to provide. The other thing is, we're a charitable organization. We want to make sure that we should be able to serve the people who need most without expecting remuneration for that. So then you kind of, you have to, again, have the fine line between that. And while we're looking at, for instance, where if we provide service to large commercial organizations or large state agencies with a substantial budget, then yeah, we might charge for that in the future, and we're working on a fee basis for that. But while we're looking to disadvantaged communities or small communities that are hit by disaster, and that could be like a small town in the U.S. now to remote areas in the Philippines, there's no way we will ever charge for that. Mm. It will be completely against anything that we stand for.
And who's running fundraising for you? Is that your job? Is that your wife's job?
Well, it's I'm doing it now, together with we have a woman in the U.S. who's very experienced in the fundraising process, who's doing that on part-time, assisting us. And we're looking also at things like foundations, that charitable foundations and different grant programs and all that. And like, especially in the more remote areas of the world, like this organization like USAID, who do certain kinds of funding programs. And I'm actually at the moment in a process with a gentleman who wants to come on board, who is very much qualified and who's got very good connections in the area of fundraising, who will basically, that will be part of his task to concentrate on fundraising and put fundraising structures in place.
Have you, without sort of getting into the numbers specifically, is this still a hand-to-mouth operation, or can you see 6 months into the future or a year into the future already?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, first of all, I can give you, our costs are really, really low. I mean, we did, like, to give you an example, our recent deployment in the Philippines, where we did multiple missions in the space of about 4 months, provided communications to about 3 different areas, ran medical assessments, medical training, and actually set up a local emergency response unit. That whole deployment cost us 12,500 euros for 4 months. So we're really,
and just
really,
to get it right, though, so you were using the term, you know, medical response methods, but you were setting up Wi-Fi infrastructure for them.
Yeah, well, that's okay. One unique thing that came out while we were working in the Philippines. We initially wanted to bring some medical personnel on board just to look after the team's own medical needs, because the simple reason, we don't want to burden the existing infrastructure. So in case, say, I send a team of engineers out there and somebody gets sick, we know that the medical resources there are under resourced, so we wanted to have our own medical staff there. I put a request out to my network looking for somebody like an EMT or a combat medic or somebody like that, and I got a huge feedback. I got like 12 or 13 people, very qualified, very highly recommended, who all wanted to go out with us. So we made the unusual step for this Philippines deployment to kind of say, oh, you know what, we have this pool of very experienced medical people. We know there's a need for these kind of services in the areas that we go to. Why don't we set up a medical team that goes into remote areas in the Philippines, does medical assessments, basically goes around to small villages or hamlets in remote areas, provides, first of all, first aid, anything that they can treat, kind of pre-hospital kind of care, but also writes reports on the general health of the population, any reports or raises alerts if there's any outbreak of epidemics, assesses what kind of medical service are available, and then those reports can be passed up the food chain to the UN, the Red Cross, etc. So that's what we actually did in the Philippines this time too, and that
and
was
did
such
you
a...
Find, did you find that organizations like the UN, WHO, etc., were receptive to receiving those reports, or did they find... I imagine that, especially in a hurricane situation, it can be a bit chaotic. But did you
well, yeah,
the reception?
To a certain extent. But I mean, we had pre-existing relationships with these people because our organization is also part, for instance, of a larger network called the Digital Humanitarian Network, where we work with UN OCHA, we work with NetHope, we work with a whole bunch of larger organizations. So we're also on all the briefing documents and the reports and the cluster meetings, etc. So we use those contacts to pass that information up the food chain, and if the medical staff, for instance, and also the same with the technical teams that we send out, if they encountered something that we needed, either we needed assistance with from a larger organization or that we think larger organizations need to be notified of, then we pass that up the food chain. And that generally that's, you know, they don't always act on it, but I mean, it's received, it's looked at, and it's certainly appreciated as far as I'm aware.
Sure. I'd like to go back for a second. You've mentioned several times reaching out to your network, making a call on Twitter or Facebook or something like that. Is there anything that you're using specifically technologically to maintain that network, or is it really the tools at hand that you just sort of maintain a decent Twitter profile, decent Facebook page, or are you using something specific to make sure you're always keeping a contact database up, you know, up and...
Well, I started to any time just dip it into those networks, you know, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. But then after a while, it became obviously that I needed to separate my, you know, my emergency or disaster response contacts from my general contacts and my social contacts. So we switched to an online CRM application called Nimble. I don't know if you heard of it. And Nimble is what we use now for to manage all the contacts. It's all the CRM business is maintained by that. We can track the conversations. We know when we need to get in touch with somebody, follow-ups, appointments, all that kind of stuff. So, and it lets us tag things. And we're also in the process of switching our actual website, where we've always just used the trusty old WordPress to run our website. We're now switching to something called Nation Builder, which is a kind of a content management system that was originally developed for political campaigns, but which has a fantastic backend, which lets you manage your volunteers. It lets you run multiple fundraising campaigns. It lets people create their own fundraising campaigns. You can filter volunteers or members, as they call them, by geographical location. So we're actually in a real process now in the organization where we're streamlining all our different processes, not only our front end, our deployments, but also the whole back end of the operation. We're improving on the funding level, the funding structure and structures. We're growing our core management team. So it's we're really going through almost a growth spurt.
Sure, this is an exciting time. All the entrepreneurs that are listening, I can sympathize with you about where you're at right now. You had an idea, and here you are 2.5 years later, like, wow, it's working. You know, like,
yeah,
we got to make a company out of it.
It's very much, you know, when I started this in 2010, I initially thought I'll do this for 6 months. You know, it's my, to use a big term, my contribution to humanity, and I'll do this humanitarian aid for 6 months, and then I go back on to do my general commercial business. Now, we're 4.5 years on, and it's only growing. And like we said, we mean we're operating all over the world. We have we're incorporated in the U.S. at the end of last year. We're really, really taking off. And the thing is, unlike what my background goes, I mean, I've worked in technology startups. It's quite often you work on the concept and the plan, then you get the structure, and then you execute. We've executed for the last 4.5 years, and I'm now catching up with the back end in place.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, where does all the technology go? So I'm thinking about this Nebraska effort that you just started 24 hours ago.
Yeah.
Where did the technology that you use, where is it warehoused? Where did it come from? And then, you know, how do you get it to arrive safely?
Yeah.
And then what happens when you dismantle it? Where does it go?
Yeah. Well, that's the logistical nightmare that we have to deal with every time. I mean, we have an equipment pod, as we call them. It's just such a nice word to use. We have an equipment pod here in Ireland. We have an equipment pod in the Philippines at the moment. And our main equipment pod in the U.S. is in San Antonio. So what we do quite often, and I mean, it works easier in Europe and U.S., obviously, because logistically things are just much more efficient there. But most of our equipment we have to ship in from other locations. In the U.S., for instance, it would be from our pod in equipment pod in San Antonio. In Europe, we'd have to ship it from here in Ireland. In the Philippines, for instance, we had to ship in everything from abroad, and obviously the U.S. was the nearest location. But it brings a whole lot of nightmares with you. You would expect, for instance, that in a humanitarian aid situation, that the whole customs process, if you bring in humanitarian aid supplies, would be much more efficient and would be the whole process chain would be shortened. But it actually seems to be the opposite. I mean, we experienced it 4.5 years ago in Haiti, where stuff would, not only our stuff, but supplies from other organizations would be stuck in a customs warehouse for 3 months. And the same thing is happening in the Philippines again, where A, they're trying to levy humongous amounts of customs duties on aid supplies, and B, there's a whole lot of, I'm not going to use the corruption word, but I have just done now, but there's a whole lot of bureaucracy to go through that slows those kind of things down. But I mean, in general, to give you a really short summary in how the more efficient deployments work. In the US, we deploy, initially when we decide to deploy, we send out an assessment team. That could be 1, 2, or 3 people who make an initial, go on site, do the initial assessment, and then report back to us saying, okay, this is the situation, this is what needed. We then load up a trailer of equipment from in San Antonio and literally just drive that across the U.S. to wherever it needs to be. It gets installed there on site. It gets, while it's running, and that could be 1 week to several months that is needed. It's remotely monitored, and we keep volunteers nearby who are kind of more in a support role than in an active day-to-day role. So they only interfere if any assistance is needed. And then when the need is no longer there, we literally, people are sent out there to break down the equipment, pack it up for shipping, and it goes literally, it's just driven back to our depot in San Antonio, where it's then, it's checked out if it works, it gets reconditioned if anything needs to be done, any repairs, and it then just gets passed off for future deployments.
Tell me about how you determine what is a disaster and then when it's time to clean up. So, you know, the unfortunate news is that disasters seem to be on the rise and they will continue to be on the rise. So what's the tipping point for you to activate your network? And then how do you know when to go home?
Well, there's two folds. I mean, we have the proactive and deployment where we decide to ourselves to deploy, and we have the deployments where we actually request it. And to give you two different examples, after Hurricane Sandy hit the U.S. East Coast at the end of 2012, a small organization based in Virginia that we worked with called Humanity Road decided to deploy to the Rockaway area in New York and set up a command center there to coordinate the ongoing efforts on the ground. They had no communications, and they knew that the communication systems in that area were completely knocked out. So they shot off a quick email to me and saying, okay, can you guys help us with communication needs? To which we absolutely say, absolutely. So within 24 hours of that email, we had 2 engineers on the ground with a basic set of equipment who provided internet access for this organization. Now, that completely snowballed into 3-month deployment where we were supplying connectivity to anything ranging from the fire department to FEMA to a whole range of other organizations. But that was basically, we get requested and we go out there. What we also do a lot is now we monitor ongoing weather patterns. We have a volunteer meteorologist on our team now who monitors weather patterns across the globe and who basically warns us if anything is due to happen. So We then use our different communication channels to see like what is happening, and especially when the extreme weather event materializes or an earthquake or whatever. We use social media. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard of the term social media emergency management. It uses data from social media a lot to monitor and to filter to and get an impression of what the actual impact is on the ground. Mm-hmm. And we use those kind of tools a lot to assess within the first 12 or 24 hours of a disaster happening on how severe is the disaster, how widespread is the area, and what kind of needs are there. And, you know, in 75% of our deployments, we then make the decision. We put our heads together in the team and say, listen, here's the situational report. Shall we deploy? And if the decision, majority decision is yes, then we literally start getting the process in motion of getting people and equipment out there as soon as possible. We reach out to the other organizations that we know that are deploying there. We reach out to the local authorities and make them aware that we're sending people and that our services are available, etc. So that's the proactive kind of deployment.
And so how do you know when it's time to go home?
Well, it's easy enough because the mainstay of us, what we do is connectivity. So we monitor connectivity. So there's two things we can see. The number of connections that are made to these Wi-Fi networks and the amount of data that's being transported to it. So that's an indication of, you know, if that really drops off, then yes, our service isn't needed anymore and we can go home. But a lot of cases, it's also in more first world areas like the US or like in Europe. We only provide our services until the pre-existing services are back up. So if a town is hit and the phone network and the cable network and everything goes down, we come in, put in temporary service, and as soon as the existing services are repaired, then we pull ourselves out. And we don't want to compete with existing commercial operators because, I mean, that will only create bad blood. So that's something we absolutely not do.
Sure.
We quite often end up supporting them. Like, we've been in deployments in areas where we would, for instance, if there was a small local internet service operator whose equipment was knocked out, we would donate some equipment to them. Or if they were without power, we work a lot with solar equipment, solar power to power equipment. We would donate some solar power equipment to them so they can fire up their network again and start providing a service. So that's very much, you know, it's either if the pre-existing services are back available or if our services are just not used anymore. That's the two kind of indicators that we decide when we need to pull out.
How do you prevent abuse of the system? When you set up a Wi-Fi network,
yes.
I'm sure that there may be not necessarily unscrupulous people, but also just sort of general abuse of a Wi-Fi network. Do you just have the standard lockdown on that, or is there real strict controls on how you can log in? Or
no, I mean, that's one of the things that we had to look at really early, because from a just pure technical perspective, you want to lock down and secure your network access as much as possible. Certainly in disaster response, because your backhaul connectivity, your satellite connectivity has limited speed and capacity. So you don't want somebody in a disaster response area going, okay, I've put my day's work in, I'm going to watch movies or whatever on YouTube now and suck up all the bandwidth. So that's one thing you need to consider. But you also need to consider that you have a constant flux of people coming in, volunteers, etc., who all need this connectivity. And you can't manage every user, because then you would have to have a whole bunch of systems administrator on site who authenticate every user, provide them with passwords, etc. So what we do is kind of twofold. If we set up equipment, say a Wi-Fi service in a certain area, we create two networks for just to keep it easy. One network will be secure, which will be for instance, the main disaster response agency in that area or in that building that we set up the equipment or in that structure. And that will be password protected. So they need to only authorized personnel can use it. And that would have slightly faster connection. It would have more data capacity. And we provide an open connection that just anybody can use that might be a bit slower and have a bit less data limit, but it's than everybody that we can go around handing password outs to still has access to that kind of connectivity.
Do you ever get pushback or have trouble with local authorities? You know, I can imagine police, fire services, these kinds of things. It might be difficult to navigate those relationships.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a general, you know, the whole area of disaster and emergency response is kind of changing. It used to be very much a top-down industry where even on a large global level of humanitarian work, where it would be like the likes of the UN or the government agencies or the local state agencies or the local towns that manage that themselves. There's a whole change in that in the industry since kind of, you know, coincidentally, kind of the time that we started, about 2010, where there's a lot of grassroots efforts, bottom-up kind of volunteer efforts that have kind of matured over the years, that have become very good at doing this work, and which are much more agile than the larger agencies. And there is quite often, there's still a bit of resistance from the local authorities, but I mean, they're slowly becoming aware of what we do and organizations like us what they do. But there's still kind of the tendency, if a disaster hit an area, the local authorities kind of tend to, first of all, first reaction, shut everything down. Don't let anybody in and out. Don't let any news in and out. Don't control the whole thing. That won't work. It's already not working, and mm-hmm. It won't work in the future. I mean, we live in an open society. Data is open. Information is open. Communication is open. You know, technology is open. So there's a slow movement towards from authorities to also allow that and realize that in disaster response, unofficial or as even as FEMA calls them, informal organizations are just as efficient and quite often more efficient than the old hierarchy of emergency response. So that's it's growing, it's getting there. You know, I mean, it will take another few years before it's really fully recognized. But, you know, once organizations see that you're doing good work and that you validate and you have a decent structure and, you know, our like organizations like us, we have a record also. So, you know, we're not completely complete strangers. So, you know, it's normal. I mean, you know, they have to keep some control and they can't let every Tom, Dick and Harry into the area because there's unfortunately been instances in the past where disaster areas where looting or profiteering would start very soon. So they have to keep a certain amount of track of who goes in and out.
And so you give them a great segue for my next question. So on one end is the local authorities, the recognized humanitarian aid agencies, et cetera. You seem to have a pretty good network in there. How do you get the word out about your service to the people who are affected by the disaster? And what's your strategy for showing them that you're legit, that you're not profiteering or anything, those kinds of things?
There's different ways. I mean, the first thing to get the word out is just good old-fashioned phone and email is, you know, when an area is hit by disaster, we look up, if we haven't been in the area and we haven't got any pre-existing relationships there, we find out, you know, who's the local town clerk, who's the local emergency commander, sheriff's department, fire department, those kind of authorities. In the U.S., you have such things as the CERT teams and the VOAD teams and FEMA, et cetera. So we have... we reach out to those networks to get the word out that we're responding there. We have a nice little two-page document that we can send them, which kind of outlines what we offer, what our experiences are, and who we've worked with before. And quite often, it's also a question of just showing up and doing it. I mean, we've been in areas where people going, yeah, you know, we're not that enthusiastic about your service, and we're not saying don't come, but, you know, what good is it? And we just go in, we put on our satellite equipment, we put our Wi-Fi up, and we put a sign up there that, you know, free internet access. And the next thing you know...
You've got 2,000 people showing up.
Yeah, you have people from every, you know, from every emergency organization and local people coming up and sitting down there. And what we do, we quite often put a few laptops up for people to use. So, you know, everybody, you know yourself, if you, even compared when you go traveling somewhere, you need to stay in a hotel, what is one of the things that you check for? Have you got internet access there?
Absolutely.
You know, we're always connected. So, you know, if that drops, people are almost lost. And, you know, and I've had the comments in the past, and I still get them from people going, but in a disaster hit area, people need food and water and medical care. Absolutely. But they also need communications because they become so dependent on communications. And even being able to send a simple message on Facebook to your family member halfway across the world and going, yeah, you know, we've been hit by a tornado, but I'm okay. My house is destroyed, but, you know, I'm temporary there or there. That's a huge thing. Another example is what happened, but certain state agencies send people, field workers into disaster areas with laptops and forms for aid applications that have to be filled in online. they don't have internet access. So, right. You know, that's something else that we facilitate. So there's a thousand and one ways that we help, and quite often it's just a question of going in there and getting the job done, and then people will actually see that it works. It's the old, you know, build it and they will come kind of approach.
Tell me, I only have a couple other questions. This has been a fascinating story, but I want to hear a story from you. What is your favorite story? You know, if you and I were sitting having a beer today, and you know, what's your stock standard favorite story of someone that your service has helped? You know, a mom or a family or whatever that you like to put on the table.
Oh God, there's so many.
That's great. I'm glad that you have the difficulty of choice. Tell me one of them.
Yeah, I mean, one of them that I really liked, and it's not, you know, it's not so much a service that saved the life per se, but to go back, for instance, to last year, Moore, Oklahoma, that was hit by a tornado. That tent camp I mentioned earlier, what was run by a motorbike gang, which was out in the sticks. It was an area kind of, I wouldn't say ignored, but it kind of fell outside the net of all the other response organizations, you know, the large state agencies and the government agencies. But it was a really well-run operation. They had these tents, and they had a recreational tent because there were 60 families in that area who had lived in trailers, and all their trailers were destroyed. And there's families there with a lot of young kids. And these kids were kind of hanging around and have nothing to do until we put 5 laptops in there with internet access. And we don't monitor emails and everything, et cetera. We don't do deep packet inspection on the data, but we kind of see how often the device is used, what kind of networks or what kind of websites are they accessing. And we saw that there was young kids, as we found out later, accessing learning websites like the Khan Academy and all that kind of stuff on a daily basis. Yeah. And I'm going, this is really cool. These kids who have basically lost everything, they're in the middle of nowhere. They have nothing really to do. And, yeah, okay, they go on Facebook too. But, I mean, you know, all kids do that. I have kids that you know, live permanently on Facebook. But these kids are also using the facility, what we put in there to learn, to better themselves. So that's something that was really cool, I thought. Another one, just a quick one in there, and it's not so much to do with communications, but when we're finding our feet in the area of disaster response in 2010 in Haiti, one of the things we shipped over there was a huge, big 160 kilowatt diesel generator, which was donated to us by a company in the US. We didn't really have a need for a 160 kilowatt diesel generator. I mean, this was like on a big trailer, but you know, this guy offered it to us. We knew electricity was a rare asset in Haiti, so we shipped that over there anyway. Once it was there, we put it in a safe storage, and I was kind of wondering, okay, what are we going to do with this? And I got a call from a gentleman, an Haitian-born gentleman living in Denver, who had set up a foundation that had just rebuilt a hospital that was destroyed in the earthquake. They had 4 operating theaters. They had an inpatient ward. They had all that kind of stuff. They had no power. But he had heard through a grapevine that, you know, here's an organization from Ireland. They actually have a really big diesel generator sitting somewhere in Port-au-Prince. So he contacted me and said, listen, would you be willing to let us use that diesel generator? And after he explained to me what it was for, I said, hold on, give me 5 minutes and call me back. So I got on to the guy who had the keys to the storage facility and said, you're going to get a call from a gentleman who wants a diesel generator. Give it to him. They can have it. So I told the guy in Denmark, I said, listen, you need to go there. It's the guy there with keys. Take the diesel generator, and it's yours. Use it. You know, you can keep it. It's not alone. It's going somewhere good. They took it. I got an email 2 days later saying, thank you for the diesel generator. This thing has been saving lives from the minute it was switched on.
Wow.
Yeah. And apparently enough, 2.5 years later, they were still using it.
That's fantastic. Those are 2 great stories. Yeah. I got to say, that's probably one of the best parts about the work that you're doing right now. You just you constantly get great stories, even when you're surrounded by the chaos and the disaster, right?
Yeah.
One question that we always end our interviews with is, tell me about you have decided to make the leap. You're in the humanitarian aid business now. You've been doing it for 4 years now, and it's just growing, it seems. What's the sage advice you either give to one of your volunteers that wants to maybe do this full time, or somebody you come across in the networks who are considering moving from the commercial world to humanitarian, or you know, someone who's, you know, completing their university, what's the advice that you give them about how to be successful doing this kind of work?
First thing, persist. Persist, persist, persist. If you think that you're doing the right thing, don't be discouraged, because there'll be 1,001 people and 1,001 reasons not to do it, but all you need is one reason to do it. If you think you're doing something that helps people in need, be it humanitarian work, be it disaster response, just commit. Knuckle down, go put your target in front of you and work towards that target. That's the number one thing, because, I mean, I still have 4.5 years on, I'm still in people telling you, you're mad, you're crazy doing what you do, you shouldn't do that, you know, you're not making money. I mean, I took a 70% drop in income, and, you know, while that stuff, you know, I took a 5,000% increase in job satisfaction.
Sure.
So really, first of all, if you think you're doing the right thing and you want to do that, go do it. Don't let anybody discourage you. Go do it. The second thing I would advise somebody is network. Because that's another thing that we learned. Reach out to other aid organizations. Talk to them. Share your experiences. Work together. Because that's really how you get stronger.
Everett, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure.
And I should say, kusunum seipan.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Terms of Reference, a weekly podcast from aidpreneur.com. Find us on iTunes or at www.aidpreneur.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.